Self-defense and Jewish law. Our graphic design department produced that striking flyer, the shadowy silhouette of someone engaged in martial arts. Many people seem to have felt that they didn't seem to have noticed the Jewish law part and were expecting to come here thinking I'm going to teach them some techniques. I'm afraid that I am not quite capable of that. I should note, though, on a slightly more serious vein, that kind of stuff is often used to just knock somebody down, get them away from you, disable. The primary discussion we're going to be having today is about more damaging self-defense, firearms. You have to actually injure, kill somebody, where you can do that with martial arts too, obviously. But the discussion today will be about the license that you have under Jewish law to...
Crosshairs
also. Okay, yeah, the crosshairs, I guess, is a firearm. So we're going to be discussing today the license that you have under Jewish law to kill, maim, destroy property, and in general take action, adverse action against someone, more than just stopping him, which is a pretty straightforward question, but to even cause permanent harm when you do so in the course of defending yourself. Now, in halacha, there isn't really a right of self-defense per se in Jewish law. Instead, we have a series of overlapping doctrines which, to a very large extent, approximate the self-defense ideas that we would find in Western law. The most obvious and important is probably that of rodef, the pursuer. Basic halacha we'll discuss presently that if you are being pursued, or even if you see a third party being pursued by someone else with malice aforethought, you can kill even, or certainly wound, injure, disable the attacker. He's considered a rodef, a pursuer, and you have the right, even the duty, to save the victim by stopping at all costs the pursuer. That's the idea of rodef. Additionally, there are several other doctrines that are relevant, several overlapping and intertwined doctrines. One is the notion of oven inish dino lenafshe. This is an Aramaic phrase. This means a man can exact justice for himself. I saw one Hebrew article refer to this type of topic as lekicha tachok biyadayim, taking the law into your own hands. Vigilantism, self-defense of person and property. Another idea that you have that instead of going through proper channels, through court, through Beis Din, to get them to stop somebody from infringing on your rights, you can sort of replace the Beis Din. You can do that yourself under certain conditions, of course. That's called oven ish din lenafshe. There's a third doctrine, which is even more removed from the classic notion of self-defense. That is the idea of kofen ala mitzvos, that Beis Din and perhaps even private citizens have the right, and again, even the duty, to enforce following the Torah for any mitzvah, not just self-defense. If the court sees someone violating a mitzvah, it is the court's job, prerogative, to step in and to apply compulsion to get people to follow the law, follow the Torah, which there are 613 commandments. Certainly, stealing someone's property or injuring somebody is a violation of the commandments, and therefore, kofen ala mitzvos, based in itself, would have the right to... Beis Din could certainly stop you from infringing on someone else's rights because you're doing an avera, and perhaps even, again, private citizens would have the right to do that, acting kind of as making a citizen's arrest, a citizen's effort to stop somebody from doing an avera, including the averas of infringing on someone else's property. So we'll discuss today these various doctrines and what their parameters are, what their scopes are, and what this means for the classic self-defense situation. So the first and most important is rodef, the pursuer. Classic case, someone is chasing somebody with a knife, a gun, threatening to kill them. Now either the victim himself wants to stop the pursuer by using lethal force, or a third party, a good Samaritan, wants to stop the pursuer by using lethal force. That is the case of rodef, and he is allowed to, and that is fine. That's the defense against the homicide charge, the defense of he's a rodef, I have to do it, I have to save the victim. And the truth is actually there is a surprising confusion or ambiguity in the sources about what the legal doctrine of killing a rodef is. I've been saying it as it is a protection for the victim, protection for the nerdef, you're saving him. There's another facet to the law, which is it's a kind of punishment for the rodef. He's doing something wrong. He's doing a capital offense by chasing somebody and attempting to kill him. He deserves to be punished. And even though normally Beis Din punishes in this sort of circumstance, it is the right and the prerogative of even private citizens to kill the rodef, thereby saving the near-death. And there are numerous implications of Talmudic passages, medieval passages, later authorities who try to untangle whether the primary focus of the laws of rodef are rescuing, saving the victim, whether the primary focus is punishing the aggressor. It seems that the more common theme is really the saving the victim, but there's also an element of punishing the perpetrator, even by a private citizen. But we can view it, I think, practically as you are essentially saving the victim. Now, Rodef applies to someone who is trying to kill somebody else. It also applies to certain heinous types of crimes, particularly rape, certain kinds of rape. Not any rape, but rape that would violate certain laws of impermitted unions, married woman, other cases like that. So it applies there too. It doesn't really apply much beyond that. If someone is trying to be Mechal Shabbos, for example, then you cannot, as a private citizen, execute him as under the category of Rodef. If someone is doing Avodah Zarah, even though that's one of the worst things you can do in Judaism, there's no justification to strike him dead because he is committing idol worship. There are some opinions in the Gemara that actually say you can, but the norm of halacha follows the view. It's only when there is a victim, basically the victim is either someone in danger of his life or someone in danger of being raped within certain conditions, then you have the right and the duty to step in to save the victim from being, by far the most common case in the literature is to save him from being killed. Practically speaking, the literature on Rodef almost exclusively concerns saving a victim from being killed by a Rodef. That's a form of self-defense. The victim himself can do it, and anybody else can do it too, can save the victim by striking down the pursuer. Now, there is one major exception to this, and this causes a lot of headaches in the literature. That is Nitin Latzilo Be'echad Me'evarav. In English, that means that you have a duty to use non-lethal force where possible before you resort to lethal force. If you're able to successfully, without any chance of failure, without any increased chance of failure, stop the pursuer by using non-lethal force, you have to do so. In the handouts, there's an article I wrote. I actually got a lot of grief for this article. It was about I wrote it in the context of the news where during all the knife-wielding terrorists in Israel, about there were complaints by the human rights organizations, the Europeans, or complaints, Americans even, complaints about Israelis using excessive force. They should have somehow disarmed the knife-wielding terrorists rather than killing them. And the question, so I used that as a springboard to write about the general question, whether you're allowed to use lethal force to stop someone with murderous intent, if you can use non-lethal force. I basically said, according to many poskim, you do have to do that, generally. People were very, very upset at me. They said they're going to do it again. This is an existential threat, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not going to discuss the politics and the specific political context over there and the fact that they're inveterate terrorists with a rate of recidivism. We're not going to get into all that stuff. But the basic, simple case, a one-off, a fellow is in this particular moment is chasing you with a knife. Now, in the movies, you can shoot the gun out of his hand. You can kick the gun out of his hand if you're as good as that guy on the flyer. You can do all kinds of things. In the real world, they generally recommend you don't try that. When someone is holding a gun on you, you shouldn't really be going in for the theatrics. You should be stopping him as quickly and as effectively as you can. So, practically speaking, it can be very. I discussed this in the article. Practically speaking, it can be very difficult to know what does it mean that there is a viable option of non-lethal force. So, the Talmud discusses a biblical episode. This occurs in Sefer Shmuel when there was a skirmish, a clash between the forces of King David, David HaMelech, and King Saul, Shaul HaMelech, or his heirs, he was dead already. So there was one particular episode where Asahel, who was one of David's men, family of Yoav, was chasing Avner, who was one of Shaul's leading generals. So Avner warned him, turn back, stop pursuing me or I'm going to have to kill you. Asahel would not stop. So Avner literally backstabbed him. While he was running, he stabbed backward with a spear and killed Asahel, who was behind him. Yoav, who was one of David's main lieutenants, was very upset about this. And later, subsequently, he killed Avner to avenge his brother. So far, the biblical text. The Talmud discusses what their debate was between Avner and Yoav, whether he had done the right thing or not. The Talmud views this through the paradigm of Rodef. Now again, whether Rodef is really the normal paradigm you would use in a military context, it's a question we're not going to get into today. Many poskim say that in military context, very different rules apply. The Gemara may have felt it wasn't really a military context. The battle was largely over. But whatever it is, the Talmud views this through the lens of Rodef. On the one hand, Asahel was a Rodef of Avner. He was going to kill Avner. Avner had the right to defend himself by neutralizing, killing, if need be, his pursuer, Asahel. On the other hand, the Talmud says, Yoav said, you should have incapacitated him. You could have neutralized him without killing him. Avner says, I couldn't. He was chasing me. He was in hot pursuit. What am I supposed to do? How could I have managed to neutralize him without killing him? So Yoav says, according to the Talmud, the Torah, the biblical text, describes Avner as having killed him by a precision thrust through a particularly weak point in Asael's body. It was a surgically accurate thrust. If you were so accurate, a near-lethal strike, you could have done something similar to neutralize him non-lethally, and therefore Yoav felt he was guilty. He should have used non-lethal means. He could have and should have, and therefore Yoav killed him. Not entirely clear who was right. The implication is Yoav was wrong, that Avner could not really be expected to discriminate, to properly make such a thrust. But in general, that kind of highlights the problem we have in the real world. Police officers always have this. Realistically, when can you expect somebody to use non-lethal force in real-world situations? It's very difficult to know, but in theory, at least, this is a doctrine which is widely accepted by the poskim. You do have a duty to attempt to use non-lethal means before using lethal means, and the implication is, the Talmud explicitly says, that if you do choose to use lethal means when you could have, assuming arguendo that you could have used non-lethal means, you lose your dispensation of self-defense, you lose the paradigm of rodef no longer applies, you are then guilty of murder. The Gemara actually says you'll be executed as a murderer if you could have used non-lethal means. Not everyone accepts that. Some poskim say even though you have a duty to use non-lethal force, you don't become a murderer if you don't do that. You simply have done a sin, but you don't actually become a murderer. That's debated. But certainly everyone pretty much agrees you do have a duty to use non-lethal force if you can without having to actually kill the pursuer. Now, there is, based on this, we have a very interesting discussion about stand your ground laws, castle doctrine, duty to retreat, and so on. In the United States, the rest of the world, there are two different views, two different perspectives on a person's right to use lethal force when he could avoid the confrontation by retreating. You're standing there on your front lawn, maybe inside your house, on a public street, in your workplace. You're standing there and somebody begins to threaten you with lethal force. You can simply defuse the confrontation by leaving, retreating. Or if you stay where you are, then you will be in mortal danger and you'll need to defend yourself by killing your assailant. Can you say, if I kill him, it's in self-defense. I'm here, I'm where I am, I choose not to go away, and then if he continues to threaten me, I'm going to have to kill him. Or do we say, Nitin Latzila Bechar Meivarov, you can solve the problem without using lethal force. How do you do that? By retreating. Maybe you should retreat. This is a state-by-state thing. In some jurisdictions, there is a duty to retreat. Not strictly speaking a duty, the lawyers explain, but it's more you lose your right to claim self-defense. You are no longer considered acting in self-defense if you have a solution of retreating. Others say no. Other states have stand your ground laws. You have the right to say, I'm here, this is where I am. If I wouldn't be here, I wouldn't be in danger, but I am here and I don't have to leave. And if you continue to threaten me, then I will shoot you dead. That is the idea of stand your ground. Related is the castle doctrine, going back to English common law, where a man's home is his castle. Certainly if you're in your own home particularly, or even your car, or maybe your workplace, if you're in your own property, you no longer have a duty to retreat. You have the right to stand your ground. Again, state by state thing. And you can probably guess yourself, you know, what sorts of political jurisdictions have one or the other. The more pro-gun jurisdictions, the more pro-rugged individualist, southern states tend to have more stand your ground laws, while the more liberal, the less gun friendly jurisdictions will often have duty to retreat.
What is retreat? Does that mean property, defending your property?
Retreat would mean retreat in the simplest and narrowest case would mean leaving the scene of the confrontation to avoid having either of you using lethal force.
Protecting versus.
So we'll discuss a little bit soon, both from the legal and halakhic perspectives, the more general duty to comply with negative demands. The idea that if he wants you to stop doing something or to give something up and you don't want to, is that also part of duty to retreat? So let's first turn to the halakha for a minute and discuss what the halakhic attitude toward a duty to retreat is versus a right to stand your ground. And the truth is, this exact question is debated by recent poskim, last century and a half, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach and Rav Yehuda Waldenberg, earlier poskim, the Kli Chemda, or Meir Dan Platsky. This actually, we find both perspectives reflected in the halakhic literature. Some say, you can stand your ground. You have the right to say, I'm here, this is what I'm doing, this is what I'm up to. If you're going to kill me, then the fact that I can defuse the confrontation by walking away, that doesn't matter. Right now, my life is threatened. Right now I have a problem, and I can kill you to solve that problem. Others say no. The same way you have to use non-lethal force if you can, the same way you have to disable and stun and knock him down if you can without killing. So here you have a way of defusing the confrontation without using lethal force, by retreating. by complying with the demands of the aggressor. So you have to do that. There are some great discussions of this by Professor Eugene Vallack, a local, I think. So he's written about. Oh, LA. I'm sorry. Okay, UCLA. I forgot that. Yeah. So he's written about stand your ground. Well, I think some of his colleagues are GW or Jordan, some of the local schools. But yeah, he himself is right.
He writes for the Post.
Right. That's so he's written about stand your ground laws and so on. He discusses the more general idea of duty to retreat, which is based on the Model Penal Code. Some states have implemented it. A duty to comply with negative demand. Someone comes to you and says, "Stop eating that sandwich. Stop protesting here. Stop burning that flag. Stop picketing this building. If you don't, I'll kill you." Now, you can defuse the confrontation by acceding to his demand and by his negative demands and by refraining from doing whatever he doesn't want you to do. Or you can say, "This is what I'm doing. If you try to kill me, I'll kill you first." So similar to duty to retreat, some states actually have this rule too, that you have a duty to comply with negative demands. He argued, at least a few years ago, he's argued that very few prosecutors have ever tried to convict somebody based on a failure to comply with a negative demand. He had one particular crazy case, but in general, involving somebody was bothering someone about a relationship he'd had with the guy's wife. The guy said, "Leave me alone, I don't want to talk about it." And the guy said, "I'm going to get my gun if you don't stop bothering me." So the adulterer pulled out a gun and shot the husband and said, "I was in danger of my life." So the question again was, did he have a duty to comply and leave him alone? Or that's not conduct that's particularly socially valuable, Vallack points out. But the statutes as written just say that you have a duty to comply with any negative demand. So it seems overbroad. So what about halacha? So the posting I mentioned earlier discussed this general question, duty to retreat, or more generally, duty to comply with negative demands. The sandwich case I mentioned earlier, they discuss whether if you're minding your own business, eating your sandwich, someone comes and says, "I don't want you to eat that sandwich. Throw it away. Stop eating it or I'll shoot you." So again, some poskim have said, Klichemda has said, no problem. You can continue eating the sandwich. If he still proceeds to threaten violence, you can shoot him dead where he stands. Other poskim say, no, you have a duty to use non-lethal force, and therefore you have a duty to retreat, duty to comply, and therefore you can no longer use non-lethal force. Some posts can actually extend this even to a case where the sandwich is usser, even when it's a ham sandwich, that you can say, "I'm eating it. It's between me and God that I'm eating a ham sandwich. If you continue to threaten me, I'm going to keep eating the sandwich and I'm going to shoot you." Other posts can distinguish that, no, a ham sandwich, you do have a duty to comply and stop eating it and don't kill him. But a kosher sandwich, the bagel is fine. A bagel, you can say, "I'm going to eat it, and if you keep bothering me, I am going to shoot you." So this question, this tension between stand your ground and versus duty to comply, duty to retreat, is explicitly reflected in the discussions of contemporary authorities. Now, we mentioned earlier there's a fundamental tension in the laws of Rodef between whether the primary doctrine is saving the victim as opposed to punishing the perpetrator, punishing the aggressor. And we said that the primary purpose, the preponderance of the literature, seems to indicate that the primary goal is to save the victim. So what happens then if the person who's endangering the victim is not doing so out of any malice? What if he's a child? What if he's even an infant who's endangering his mother's life through no conscious decision of his own? So some of these questions are discussed by the Talmud. The Talmud discusses both the questions of the child and the infant. The Talmud rules, it's a discussion, but the Talmud rules that even a child who is threatening the life of somebody else, deliberately the Talmud seems to say, but even though he's a child and is normally not criminally liable for any actions that he takes, a child will still be considered a rodef and still can be killed if he is endangering the lives of others. The question, however, is what about an infant? So this was a terribly tragic case. I wrote about it in one of the articles there. You have the case in the Holocaust, but they actually go back a few hundred years earlier to the Khmelnytsky uprisings in Tach V'Tat in the 17th century. There was a terrible, terrible, tragic case where some Jews were hiding from the murderous Cossacks, and a woman was hiding in some bunker somewhere with an infant, literally an infant, a few weeks old. The infant was crying, he was hungry or something, so the women tried to prevent the child from giving away their location. They tried to keep him quiet, and they smothered the child, either deliberately or just in the course of trying to keep him quiet, they smothered him. So the question was, we don't have any in Jewish communities, we don't practice criminal jurisprudence, but the question was, tshuva, murder or or you know, serious kinds of manslaughter were considered crimes. And even though we don't execute people, we require formal penance, formal tshuva. So the question was, is she considered a murderer? Or part of the analysis is the child considered, the infant considered a rodif? So we have the Gemara. The Gemara says even a child is considered a rodif. But this particular analysis by the Divrei Rinana, a leading scholar of the time, said that an infant is not a rodif, and therefore the act of killing him would be considered murder, in spite of the fact that it was done to save the lives, maybe not capital murder, but it would be considered a serious crime of murder or some pretty serious kind of manslaughter. And the argument he makes is he distinguishes between a child and an infant. A child still is capable of forming conscious thoughts and deliberately tries to kill somebody, he becomes a rodif, even though he's not criminally liable, he's not an adult, but he's still able to make a decision to pursue and endanger and inflict harm on another. An infant has no such possible designation. An infant simply acts according to his nature. He makes no decisions. He brings the case we mentioned earlier, much of the classic discussion on this topic, as well as the topic of abortion in general, arises from a classic Talmudic case of a woman who is having a difficult delivery, and the problematic delivery is endangering the mother's life. So the rule is that we are permitted to abort the fetus until it has crowned, until the head has emerged. Once the head has emerged, we no longer may kill the child, the infant, the fetus, whatever you want to call it, even if it is necessary to do that to save the mother. So the exact logic of this distinction is not entirely clear. There's extensive discussion about it in the Rambam, Maimonides, and the commentators. But basically, the most straightforward, the most compelling approach to this distinction seems to be an infant is not a rodef. It doesn't formulate thoughts. It doesn't have intention. It's just doing what its nature is. It's not making any decision, any autonomous decision to endanger the mother. Therefore, the infant is not a rodef. The fact that you can terminate it before it emerges is because it's not fully a person then, and even though Jewish law doesn't allow abortion on demand, but here, where it's not fully a person and it's endangering the mother, you can kill it, but it's not really a rodif. Once it emerges and it's a full-fledged person, which is defined by the head emerging, it does not have the status of a rodif, and therefore he may no longer be killed. And that, therefore, is the position of the Divrei Rinana, that certainly an already born infant, even if he is endangering the lives of other people, since he's not doing so deliberately and consciously, he does not have the status of a rodif. So in spite of what we said earlier, that the primary doctrine of rodif is to save the victim, that still only applies if the rodif is doing so consciously and deliberately, not if he's simply an infant who has no autonomy. A similar question is discussed even with regard to adults. If the adults doing the endangering have no knowledge, no understanding, no intention to endanger. There are various cases that arose out of Israeli military conflicts, friendly fire situations. An Israeli plane mistook ground forces for being enemy forces. The planes descended into an attack pattern to attack the ground forces. People on the ground realized but were unable to communicate successfully to the plane that they were about to open fire on friendly forces. The question arose, do they have the right to shoot down their own plane who is endangering innocent Jewish lives? Related question came up during in the aftermath of the World Trade Center attacks, the stuff of a lot of movie plots, but real world situations too, where if you know that airplanes have been hijacked and are heading toward buildings, can you shoot them down? You can obviously kill the terrorists who are doing the hijacking, and we're not shedding any tears for them, but the question is, there are innocent civilians on that plane. They're not doing anything through any fault of their own. They made no decision to endanger anybody's life. So can you shoot down that plane, knowing that you'll be killing people who have made no decision to be a rodif? They are, their existence, and the plane is endangering innocent people, but you'll be killing other innocent people to save the first group of innocent people. Do they have the status of a rodif or not? So again, this is debated. Some poskim argue, Rav Yashiv Zichrono Livracha is reported to have argued, that by analogy to the child, a child, he understood, is like an infant, he has no liability at all. Nevertheless, you can kill him because at the end of the day, as a matter of fact, he is endangering the victim's lives, and therefore, at the end of the day, you have to shoot down these planes, even if the pilot is innocent, even if the passengers are innocent, doesn't matter, you have to do whatever it takes to save innocent lives from being the victims of aggression. Others have argued no, either because, as we've just said,
the passengers are distinct from the child in the sense that they themselves are victims of aggression.
Yeah, so the passengers arguably have certain additional complications, and they're not actually the ones who are causing any danger. They're simply in the plane. The plane is causing the danger. They're simply being dragged along for the ride. So that gets us into even more complications. We're not going to get too deeply yet. But that is a distinction. We're not going to get too deeply into that. Rav Eliashiv is reported to have ruled that you cannot shoot down the plane for a different reason. He's argued that even if you accept that someone who has no criminal motive is still a rodef, but here, where the motive was explicitly good, he was trying to save Jewish lives by attacking the enemy, because he actually is operating on a mission of the public interest, then he's somehow cannot be classified as a rodef. An interesting idea. He brings another case of a woman once fainted, case in the Chasam Sofer about 200 years ago. A woman once fainted, and another woman attempted to revive her by pouring water on her face, by pouring water down her throat. Instead, she, in the chaos of the situation, she poured kerosene on the woman and wound up killing her somehow. So again, the question is, in theory, if someone realized what she was doing and was unable to communicate with her and stop her in time, could he have killed her? Would she be a rodef? And he says, no. Again, the idea is, if you mean well and you're trying to do good, then you can't be classified as a rodef. Again, that's a speculative idea. But the basic point is that the extensions of rodef past the classic case of guy with a knife, deliberate autonomous agent, to cases where you're endangering someone but not with any malice, is the subject of considerable dispute.
But you said the pilot was doing a mission of public good, correct? That's why you wouldn't,
yes.
That's why you wouldn't be allowed to shoot down.
That's one opinion, yes.
But aren't we concerned with the... Isn't the focus supposed to be on the perpetrator's actions? Because we all agree that the pilots and the passengers are essentially in the position of bystanders in this case.
Yeah, well, I was discussing the pilot in the case of the IDF case, where the pilot is engaged in about to attack friendly fire. He means well. He's trying to attack enemy forces, but instead he thinks he's doing something for the public good by killing enemies. So he's operating.
Oh, okay.
And
so he's not Chayim.
According to one opinion, he wouldn't be considered a rodef. Yeah.
Okay, got it.
Yes. Yes.
Directive or you'll be killed. I think the logic of the other side is that, well, there's no end to it, because if the guy comes into my house and says, get out of your house or I'll kill you, and then he can chase me outside and say, go back in your house, so there's no end to it. What are the post-game who take the other side, the side that you do have a duty to comply with a negative command?
So,
how do they deal with
so that's a good question. Is there a dividing line? Is there some limit to the application of this rule? It's difficult to know. I should emphasize that most of the literature we're quoting is really academic. The halakhic literature is really academic and abstract. There's very little. The case I mentioned about the baby smothered in the bunker, it was a real world case, but most of the cases we're discussing were really purely academic discussions. There's very little of this being applied to the real world. So obviously, in the real world, we have to answer these kinds of questions of boundaries, of slippery slopes, of distinctions, either bright line distinctions or some kind of totality of the circumstances type of analysis. But yeah, the halakha literature, as far as I know, lacks these kind. We can discuss like theories and ideas, but we lack the extensive real world application to answer that question properly.
In the case of the person who's being threatened, let's say that retreat is not physical. So we know that he has a license to kill the person pursuing it. Does he have a requirement to do that?
Yes. So in general, the rule is, Post can point out, they specifically, Itamar Varhaftig, contrast this to secular law, where there are generally rights, but generally no real duties of helping someone else. And Good Samaritan is not usually a legally binding duty. Halacha does have duties. You do have the mitzvah of Lasamar al Dam Reyecha, the mitzvah of Ashar Saveda. There are a number of mitzvahs that require a Jew to come to the aid of his fellow in danger. So certainly if you saw somebody being attacked by somebody else, and you can, certainly if you can safely intervene to save him, you have an obligation to do so. You're not considered a murderer if you don't. There's no penalty if you don't, but you have violated a mitzvah if you don't. As to the victim himself, presumably, I don't know if you have a mitzvah of Losamar al Dam Reyecha on yourself, but presumably you do have an ethical obligation to preserve your life, which I imagine would extend, you probably would be supposed to, if you ask the rabbi, if you have time to make a phone call, what is the right thing to do? The answer would probably be you should kill. As a matter of fact, I want to just move to one next step on that, which is that there is an idea discussed by a number of different authorities that the victim himself, even though we keep saying that both the victim and third parties have a right and even a duty to intervene, the victim's right to do this in some ways, according to some opinions, is much broader. So, for example, we were discussing the idea of a duty to use non-lethal force. Some authorities say that duty only applies to a bystander. The victim himself, some say, always has the right to use lethal force. We discussed the case of Avner and Asahel. Some say that that was Avner's defense, that he always had the right to use non-lethal force because the victim himself has no such restriction. And so on. The Meiri had said, in the case of the difficult labor, he said that the only ones who can terminate after the baby's head has emerged are midwives or doctors or third parties, but the mother herself, if she's able to, if she has the presence of mind, can always kill it because she herself, the person who's in danger, has a much broader right to do that. The exact legal doctrine that would allow that is not so clear. Some say it's just a practical thing. It's not reasonable to expect the person who's actually in danger of his life to make these kinds of fine distinctions. He's too caught up in the moment. Maybe there are other arguments, more legalistic arguments, but there are those who make the distinction. But in any event, the general idea of the poskim is that the person who's in danger has broader authority than third parties. So that's a general question, whether a person can give up his life because of even where the Torah says you're allowed to act, like can you decide you don't want to be Mechal Shabbos and you'd rather get killed? Can you decide you don't want to eat treif and get killed? Usually you're not allowed to do that. In most cases, you're not allowed to say, certain cases where not to make a Kiddush Hashem, if non-Jews are forcing you to do it, in certain cases, according to some authorities, you have the right to do that. In these types of cases, in this case, where on the one hand, you have a duty to save your life, on the other hand, you have a pacifist sense, you don't want to kill somebody else, I'm not sure. At the end of the day, he's a human being too. My sense would be that the right thing to do would be that you do have a moral obligation to do it, but I'm not absolutely certain about that.
How does this fit with the permission to kill a thief in your house at night?
Yes, so permission to kill a thief, this is actually, I think according to Wikipedia, this is actually advanced by some early English jurists as kind of one of the biblical paradigm for the notion of self-defense. This is what we call the law of the machteris. You, the homeowner, see somebody tunneling into your home with criminal intent to steal, so you can kill him. However, as understood by the Talmud, this is because your life is in danger. The way the Talmud explains this, you have a reasonable fear that he will kill you. It's kind of convoluted, but the idea is that you believe that he believes that you will defend yourself by killing him, and therefore he's prepared to kill you, and therefore you can kill him. Now, there is a question. If you can somehow just run out of the house, and again, the same kind of question. If you can run out of the house, he'll have no reason to kill you. You'll just say, take it all, keep everything, I'm leaving. So then the question is, again, if you have a reasonable possibility to do that and save yourself, that would be the same question we're discussing. Do you have the right to stand your ground, stay in the house, and say, okay, I'm going to have to kill you because I'm staying here, and as long as I'm staying here, my life is in danger? So that would be an interesting question. But yes, in general, it's very similar to the law of Rodif. The idea, as understood by the oral Torah, is that you can kill him because you reasonably believe your life is in danger, and it would be subject, possibly, to many of the ins and outs that we've been discussing until now. Now, I just want to spend a few minutes discussing a related doctrine we mentioned earlier, the idea of Avad Nishdin L'Nafshei. The Talmud says, if you see someone coming to steal from you, take your property, you have the right, it's a discussion in the Talmud, but the ruling is you have the right to use force to prevent him from stealing. You don't have to wait to go to Beis Din. You can say, I'm taking the law into my own hands. I'm going to maybe even hit you, maybe even injure you, stop you from taking my property. Avad Nishdin L'Nafshei. Now, it's not actually clear whether this extends to lethal force or not. The Talmud gives examples where you take a stick. If someone's coming to, the Talmud talks about a case, somebody had a cistern of water for irrigation purposes, and somebody was coming to take his water without permission. It says, what's the problem? Take a stick, and if he comes over, then hit him on the head, and hit him and knock him down and stop him from taking your water. It doesn't actually discuss, and according to many posts, that means even injuring him. Talmud does not clearly discuss whether you can use lethal force to do this. Some people have categorically assumed that lethal force is out of the question. You're only permitted to use lethal force to prevent a danger to life. You can certainly not use lethal force. My brother-in-law, Rabbi Nathaniel Wiederblank, gave a major share on the topic of stand your ground laws at Yeshiva University. I was going through his notes in which he asserted that it's obvious, he says, that there is no right to use lethal force to merely stop financial harm to yourself. If you're in no danger of your life, not the Machtera situation where you have a reason to believe he may kill you, there's no danger at all, you see a thief sneaking through, he's already running away, you see him with that sack over his shoulder with all the silverware in it, he's already running, his back is to you, And you know, if you don't shoot him, he'll disappear into the shadows and you'll never get back your silverware. So the law apparently is actually, again, state by state. According to Volokh again, many states do have laws that generally you can use self-defense, lethal force, and self-defense is legitimate to prevent danger to life, serious bodily harm, rape, and according to some states, certain other serious felonies, including certain types of robberies. I actually was reading on one of the liberal blogs, I think it was Think Progress, they were giving examples of egregious examples of gun-happy Texas-style self-defense laws. They had an example. In Texas, you can kill somebody even to avoid burglary and to avoid him stealing your property and retrieve your property, either to stop him from stealing or to retrieve your property. The law apparently does allow you, in some states at least, to use lethal force to prevent certain types of felonious conduct that doesn't involve physical harm, that merely involves harm to your property.
That's even off your property?
He's already left and is in the public street?
Yeah.
I'm not such an expert on the laws, so I'm not going to get too deeply into the details, but I think so. I think the implication is that, if he's absconding with your property and you can stop him by using lethal force, if he's doing it in a felonious way, according to whatever, I'm not sure. I'd have to read the statutes more carefully. So my brother-in-law had said the halacha has no such notion, and surprisingly, it's actually not so clear in halacha whether you can use lethal force to stop a burglar. There isn't. This brings us to the third principle I mentioned, makinos o achetetei nafsho.
Isn't the whole Gemara in Sanhedrin by machteres before that? It's not to protect the property itself.
Yeah, so there's no question that, again, as Rabbi Winter is pointing out, there's no question that the machteres paradigm of shooting the burglar, it's clear from the sugya that the dispensation being discussed, as we said, is to save your life. That's why the Gemara says, if you know he's not going to kill you, he's your father, and you know you're in no danger, you cannot kill him. So you'd have to review the passage carefully, but that may be because you can still save the property damage by doing something else. Once you're not in danger of your life, the property may anyway not be in danger because you can stop him using other ways. Once you've caught him, you can save the property. I'm not sure. You'd have to read the Gemara carefully. There are those who argue that halacha does allow you to use lethal force to avoid loss of property. This is based on the principle of makinos v'achetetei nafsho. The rule is, again, we mentioned earlier, that Beis Din can step in if they see somebody eating a ham sandwich or be Michal Shabbos. It's Beis Din's job to enforce compliance with the laws of the Torah. So Beis Din would have the right to step in and say, stop being Michal Shabbos, stop driving that car on Shabbos, stop worshiping Avodah Zarah, stop eating the ham sandwich, and if you don't, we're going to use physical compulsion to stop you. That's Beis Din. What about private citizens? If you see somebody eating a ham sandwich, do you have the right to strike him to get him to drop the sandwich? Again, if you can do it with less than that, if you can just take the sandwich away, obviously that's preferable. But if you can't, if the only way to get him to stop eating the ham sandwich is by physically assaulting him, so this actually is a dispute among the poskim. The Ksos HaChoshen says a private citizen has no right to do this. That's limited. Well, the Ksos HaChoshen actually distinguishes between mitzvah saseh and los saseh, but some poskim say that you have no right to strike somebody to get him to stop eating a ham sandwich. The Nesivos HaMishpat seems to understand that private citizens too have the right to use physical force to prevent their fellows from doing averus. Now, the Talmudic language is makinoso achetetei nafsho. If a person doesn't want to take a lulav, doesn't want to put on tefillin, he can be struck until he dies. The question is that literally, does the Gemara mean that literally? You can actually keep hitting him until he dies. So people bring the Ar Samech or Meir Simcha of Divinsk, who says no. He says the heter to hit him is only because maybe he'll do the mitzvah. Once he's dead, he can't do the mitzvah. So you have no right to hit him unless the hitting will possibly result in his doing the mitzvah. You certainly can't hit him if you're actually going to kill him. Other poskim seem to understand that makinos achetetei nafsho could literally mean that you can hit him as long as he's in violation of the mitzvah. You can keep hitting him. You can keep hitting him as a means of getting him to stop being in violation. I guess if he's dead, he's no longer violating the mitzvah. I'm not sure if that's the logic. In any event, the Nesivos HaMishpat does say that if someone is committing a felonious injury of property to you, stealing your property or destroying your property, so the Nesivos says, in general, you would have no right to strike him dead because, again, you have the option of using non-lethal force. Take him to court or do something else. There are other ways, there are other things you should be trying before using lethal force. There are people who argue that the Nesivos implies if there was no other way, like the example I gave where he's getting away, the burglar is getting away, if you don't shoot him now, again, if you could knock him down and tie him up until the cops come fine, but if you can't do that, if it's either shoot him and kill him or let him get away, then the Nesivos seems to imply that because of the rule of makinos v'achetetei nafsho, Stealing is also a violation of a mitzvah. He's lo sigzal, the heshev esegzela. He's also committing violations of various sins. And therefore, there are those who seem to argue that even for property damage, that would fall into the general heter, the general dispensation to use force, even lethal force, to secure your rights as based on the principle of oven nishdin l'nafshei. But putting aside using threats to life, the general rule is well accepted that you have the right to use force, certainly force like in our flyer again when you knock somebody down. Whether you can actually injure somebody to stop him from burglarizing you is a little bit less clear. The Rambam seems to feel that you cannot cause actual injury, personal injury to someone to stop him from causing burglaries. Other poskim say you can. The Talmud seems to imply that you can. This is another idea of self-defense, kind of taking the law into your own hand. Beis Din itself certainly has the right to use physical compulsion to stop people from sinning. And you yourself, you can act kind of as your own citizen's self-deputized version of Beis Din to stop people from committing these sins. And again, here you see the same kind of duality between the way halacha works. Whenever a Jew is committing some crime against your property, there are two problems. He's committing a sin. He's violating lo sigzal, the prohibitions against theft, or other prohibitions against infringing on another's rights. Also, you as a victim are suffering, you or someone else are suffering from some danger to your property. So again, just as we discussed in Rodev, there are two components to the dispensation. There's the notion that he's doing something wrong and he needs to be punished or stopped because he's an avarian. B, we have a victim who needs to be saved, and there are elements of both. Similarly, Avdin Shdin L'Nafshei works in a similar way. On the one hand, he's doing something wrong. Makinos Achtetin Nafsho, Afrushim Eisura, he's doing something wrong, and therefore you can stop him because you have to stop him from doing Averis. Specifically, this Aver has a victim. The victim might be you, the victim might be a third party, and therefore you have the right and the duty to save the victim's property by using some level of force. Now again, whether it applies to lethal force is speculative. It can be argued, perhaps, as my brother-in-law does, that lethal force is not no such dispensation, not entirely clear. But certainly other levels of force, there is ample basis in halacha that there is a sort of self-defense notion that's also considered self-defense, defense of property, to hit somebody else to stop him from committing a crime of property against you. Just close with one last doctrine, related doctrine. We've been discussing stopping somebody from committing a crime of property or a crime against your person. What about simply revenge, lashing out in passion and revenge? So that would seem to be a much tougher sell. You're not going to accomplish anything. You're just going to vent your frustration on him. You're just going to hit him because you're angry at him for assaulting you. So it's not going to be mutter. It's not going to be permitted. However, halacha does recognize also the notion of provocation to some extent, the notion of legitimate revenge. There are doctrines in halacha that say that if you were provoked, if someone hit you and you hit him back, if someone insulted you, insults are a tort, kind of a version of libel or public slander. These are torts in halacha. And there are doctrines in halacha that say halacha recognizes a defense of provocation. If you've been insulted or hit and you hit back, maybe you shouldn't do it, but you will, according to many authorities, be exempt from various forms of criminal and civil sanctions in halachic law because you were provoked. Valak again had a piece once. He was kind of appalled by this, but in various southern states until recently, if someone caught a man involved with his wife or his daughter or his fiancée and killed him, then you had a defense against that because it was outrageous conduct on the part of the man. And some of them have repealed it by now. He goes through the laws, mostly southern states, but Georgia, Utah, New Mexico. He actually teases out that there are no fewer than three separate, based on what the courts have said, three separate rationalizations for this. One of them is a notion of self-defense. As the patriarchal master of the house, it's your job to protect the chastity of your wives and daughters. Others have said that it's a form of provocation, that it's a defense that I was provoked. You know, what's a man supposed to do when he sees that going on? And the third one is an idea of legitimate revenge. Halacha has analogs for all three of these, somewhat. The notion of protecting the woman, we have that too. We mentioned Rodif applies to saving somebody from being raped. But again, in halacha, it's only rape. It does not apply to a consensual relationship, unlike some of the southern states, which apparently gave you the right to protect even from a consensual relationship. The idea of provocation, that's what we've just been discussing. It's not usually used, not really used about murder, but it is used about physical assault and insult. If someone provoked you first and you fought back, then there's a notion that you were provoked. It actually comes up even in the context of murder too. because some of the authorities derive this from the idea of Goel Hadam, the Torah's discussion of blood vengeance. The Torah says that the relatives of the murdered victim may strike back at the murderer. That's why you should let him have a city of refuge. They may strike back, kiyechem levavo, because their hearts will be inflamed. Some poskim understand this to mean that we understand that. We understand if someone murdered deliberately or even accidentally your relative, and you kill him, and you kill him in retaliation, we understand that. We don't blame you for that. That's a legitimate reaction a person has. Kiyechem levavo, and the idea of legitimate revenge, that's not something, revenge is not something, in cold-blooded revenge, when you're not doing it in a moment of passion, is generally not something we tolerate. But even there, the Torah does have a prohibition of losikum, of not taking revenge, but there are some authorities who argue that losikum itself is suspended when somebody punched you or insulted you and injured you physically, or insults were considered on the same level as physical injury, and you take revenge, you may not be even subject to the prohibition of losikum. Others disagree, but some say you may not be subject to the prohibition because the Torah allows, the Torah understands that it's human to take some kind of revenge. We don't like it, we don't encourage it. It's not the ideal conduct, but there are those who say that even some level of revenge is understood and somewhat understood by the Torah, even if it's not, you know, completely condoned, but it's not, but it is understood.